Hey everybody, and welcome to another episode of ZU Cast. I'm Amanda Van Hyle. I'll be one of your hosts for today. I also have with me Alex Rosenberg. He's going to be joining me as a host this week.
Hello, I am the other host of today. Huzzah!
Yay, Alex. I'm excited to be hosting with you.
Yay, we're back. And I love that I am now the host number two. That will be good on my resume.
Host number two.
Get me my equity card somehow, you know?
Exactly, right?
Give me that union status. But it's been a while since I've been able to host, so this should be fun. Yeah. And we've got quite a good show, too, which is very exciting.
Yeah, we've got a lot of really cool things this go-around. There's the Master Sword evolution. We've got creature features talking about the different bad guys and monsters in Zelda.
And we also have a couple new segments, too. We have a new guy on the team, Brian Pope, who's going to be talking about inventory acquisitions, aka all the cool Zelda things that you can get, which is very fun.
Yeah, I'm really excited for that part.
And then Ranity finishes up his Hyrule Away from Hyrule series, which is very cool. And then, of course, our favorite thing, credits.
And then bloopers.
Of which there will probably be a decent amount.
There
because
will be plenty us. Because it's us. Oh, Lord.
There's going to be a lot because we may or may not talk about other random things in the middle of
we
it.
We may burst into some kind of musical theater.
Oh, God, I'm not prepared.
I know,
I haven't
but
warmed up yet.
That's what happens when you get us both together.
With that said, we got to get back on track. Let's take it over to Brian talking about the evolution of the Master Sword.
The Blade of Evil's Bane, previously the Goddess Sword, or better known as the Master Sword, has been a recurring item in the Legend of Zelda franchise since its inception in 1991's title, A Link to the Past. Since then, the Master Sword has appeared in many different canon Zelda games, and while it mostly remains the same, slight alterations have been made from game to game. Each iteration of the Master Sword has built off the previous one, except for the handheld entries, which were limited by the technology of the time. But if you look at an illustration of the Master Sword from A Link to the Past, next to Breath of the Wild's Master Sword, the differences are very apparent while keeping the sword's identity intact. So, let's take a look at the evolution of the Master Sword throughout the ages. Starting with A Link to the Past, the Master Sword is originally found in the Lost Woods, and its depiction is slightly contradictory and a little confusing, which is mostly due to the limited technology of the time. In-game, once you discover the Master Sword in its pedestal, the sword's hilt is the familiar blue color with a golden gem that serves as a rain guard. The crossguard has a larger wingspan that we continue to see in future titles, but when Link removes the Master Sword from its pedestal and holds it above, the sword changes quite drastically. The most obvious change is the color of the hilt, which changes to red and loses its golden gem rain guard. The cross guard loses its wing shape and is reduced to a straight line. To add even more confusion, when you go into the game's menu, the sword is shown with a white hilt and a blue blade. But fortunately for us, Nintendo has provided us with official artwork for the Master Sword. The official artwork is located in Nintendo Player's Guide that illustrates a mixture of in-game characteristics. The official artwork depicts the Master Sword's hilt with a red grip and winged crossguard. The golden gem serves as a rain guard, leading to a thinner ricasso, which is the smaller part of the blade towards the end of the hilt. It's kind of the beginning of the blade. You probably know this piece of the sword. It's the one that has the Triforce carved into the blade. So, this illustration will serve as our baseline for all other Master Sword iterations moving forward. The next time we see the Master Sword is in the franchise's first 3D entry, which is Ocarina of Time. And this is how many consider the Master Sword to look. This iteration is widely considered to be the most iconic version of the Master Sword, and it's when it becomes more than just an item, but becomes part of the story. In fact, if you boil it down, the entire story of Ocarina of Time is based around the Master Sword, which almost makes it kind of a character. From the moment you see it resting in its pedestal in the Temple of Time, you understand the impact this sword has on Hyrule. The characteristics of the Master Sword in Ocarina of Time is similar to those of the first time we see it in A Link to the Past. The Nintendo 64 allowed for more graphical stability, which makes the sword look the same throughout the entirety of the game. The hilt of the sword is the familiar blue with a wing crossguard, a similar golden gem as a rain guard in the same Triforce carving from A Link to the Past. There are no upgrades to this iteration of the sword unlike A Link to the Past, which just furthers its credibility as a character in the game rather than just another item. And while this iteration isn't my personal favorite, I usually concede that Ocarina of Time's Master Sword is the de facto Master Sword when it comes to the Legend of Zelda franchise. Moving right along, we come to Capcom's Oracle of Ages and Seasons on the Game Boy Color. Since these are also limited to the technology of the Game Boy, we're not going to spend too much time here other than saying that the in-game item does have the correct coloring, which is a blue hilt and a white/gray blade. The next big entry in the Zelda franchise was The Wind Waker, and it is arguably the most controversial entry in the franchise's history. The cel-shaded art style of The Wind Waker was widely criticized at the time, and this is mostly because of a 2000 Space World tech demo, which was similar to E3, but it kind of fizzled out. And this demo showed an extremely realistic, for the time, Link versus Ganondorf fight scene. Now, with this new cel-shaded art direction of The Wind Waker, the Master Sword also received a major overhaul. Firstly, the Master Sword is noticeably smaller than all other iterations of the sword, which is likely due to Link's, now known as Toon Link, smaller stature, and the pommel of the hilt, which is the cap of the hilt, is much larger than previous iterations. There are three different phases of the Master Sword in The Wind Waker, and while all three look similar, there are slight differences between each. Throughout the game, you will notice that the crossguard and the gem of the rain guard is somewhat indicative of the sword's power level. When you first discover the Master Sword, it has the blue hilt and a thinner crossguard with a dull black gem as a rain guard. The first upgrade to the Master Sword forces the thin crossguard to jet out, resulting in the most pronounced wing-shaped crossguard in the Zelda franchise. And the final upgrade to the Master Sword sees the dull black gem turn to the familiar gold gem rain guard, but also illuminates the blade. This is the first time that we see the Master Sword emit a glow from the blade itself, and continues to be a staple of the Master Sword throughout the franchise. Back in 2016, Twilight Princess introduced slight changes to the blade and added my personal favorite change to the Master Sword, and it's become a mainstay, and that's the green wrap. The sword's hilt has a green wrap that is entwined into the hilt's grip. Along with this wrap, Twilight Princess also elongated the blade's length to make it more of a long sword rather than Ocarina of Time's shorter blade. Subtle additions of gold leafing to the Master Sword's ricasso adds a nice touch of detail that runs from the rain guard to the Triforce carving. The pommel has also returned to a normal size, and the last little detail that has changed to the Master Sword in Twilight Princess is the crossguard includes two sharp points near the hilt's grip, which also becomes a mainstay for the next few iterations. Our next iteration of the Master Sword is canonically the very first Master Sword, as we discover in Skyward Sword. Before being upgraded, this Master Sword was previously known as the Goddess Sword, and has a different color scheme, but looks visually very similar. I know we aren't talking about the Goddess Sword, but I felt like I should mention it briefly, since it is part of the Master Sword's history. The Goddess Sword has a green hilt and a curved crossguard, with golden green rain guards, and a kind of bluish glow inner part of the blade. But, let's get back to the topic at hand. Skyward Sword has two phases of the Master Sword, and the first phase has many characteristics of previous versions, like the winged crossguard, the gold gem rain guard, and the blue hilt, which does include the green wrap. But the crossguard is also much thinner and closer to the blade, similar to what we see in the first phase of the Wind Waker's Master Sword. Also, the Triforce carving on the ricasso seems to be missing. However, the second phase of the Master Sword is much more reminiscent of Twilight Princess's iteration. The crossguard is back to its normal wing shape, and we see the Triforce carving restored, but the grip of the hilt seems to be slightly thinner. The ricasso is missing the gold leafing, but is replaced with small gold reinforcements that come up from the rain guard and bend around the edge of the blade. And while we never see this iteration of the Master Sword in-game, it's worth mentioning that the promotional artwork for Skyward Sword boasted a gorgeous new color scheme for the blade that consisted of a bluish-green aura, which I believe was supposed to be representative of Fi, but we'll never really know. Our next appearance of the Master Sword was in the hit 3DS game, A Link Between Worlds. While this game's art style isn't the most accurate representation of the Master Sword, Nintendo did a great job of recreating it. The Master Sword is short, like the Wind Waker, but looks more along the lines of Ocarina of Time. The hilt is blue with a curved crossguard and leads to a gold gem rain guard and the carving of the Triforce. The blade is much shorter and more bulbous at the top, and is seemingly missing a ricasso, so the Triforce seems to be carved onto the bottom of the blade. The biggest and most notable change in the design of A Link Between Worlds Master Sword is the grip of the hilt. Instead of the trademarked green wrap, there seems to be two small blue gems encrusted in the hilt. However, I should also mention that there are two upgrades to the sword that dons a red blade for level 2 and a golden blade for level 3. Outside of the blade color and the power level, there aren't many differences between the original sword and its upgrades. And finally, we have come to the most recent evolution of the Master Sword as of this recording. The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild introduced my favorite iteration of the Master Sword to date, but probably not the one you're thinking of. No, it isn't the one that you use during your roughly 200-hour playthrough, but the rusted, damaged Master Sword of Resurrection. I remember first seeing it and wondering why it was in such disarray, and what could have caused such chaos to the legendary Master Sword. Sadly, we never fully understand how it had become so badly damaged. But we do see the Sword of Resurrection in a memory within Breath of the Wild, and one could speculate, but we're not going to do that here. All we know is that it is placed in the pedestal damaged, and then when we find it in-game, it's been restored. And that's extremely unfortunate, because that could have been such an amazing plot point within Breath of the Wild. However, the Master Sword that we do get is quite a sight to behold. The art style and its color scheme is so bold and bright in Breath of the Wild, and that makes the Master Sword almost jump off the screen. And that's not even when it's glowing fully powered. When it is fully charged, the glowing makes it even more prominent. The overall design of the Master Sword is very similar to Skyward Sword, if not exactly the same. From the pommel all the way to the tip of the blade, everything is the same. The blue hilt, the green wrap, the gold gem rain guard, winged cross guard, even the gold reinforcements along the edge of the blade on the ricasso. Alright, that's it. That's all the Master Swords I have for you today, and as for what's next, I can't wait to find out what the creative geniuses over at Nintendo come up with. My hope is that they continue the trend of small changes between games while still keeping the core identity of the Master Sword intact. Also, I'd love to hear what your favorite version of the Master Sword is, and the best place to let me know is over on Twitter. My handle is itsamebt, that's itzamebt. Thanks for listening. And now, back to Alex and Amanda.
So, Alex, didn't you do an episode of Mailbag on the Master Sword also?
Yeah, I did a couple years ago. Unfortunately, that episode's actually not available to watch anymore because I pulled all of it in favor of Zelda 101, which also kind of fell apart. I'm going to retool a lot of those episodes into their own, like, series, I think, at some point, and old one-offs. But I think what I find really interesting about what Brian talked about was a lot about how, like, the color scheme was a thing, which I didn't actually talk about much when I made the video. And I didn't even think about, like, how, specifically with Wind Waker, the design of that and how, like, Space World kind of threw everything off. Space World in general kind of threw off a lot of things for Zelda, because that demo of the realistic Link and Ganon set up so many unrealistic expectations about the new Zelda game. And so when Nintendo turned around and was like, psych, boats, deal. Everyone was like, no, but...
like, we want our angsty Zelda. What is this?
We want Hot Topic Link, god damn it. It's all they I wanted
hot,
in my
we
life.
We got Hot Topic Link after Wind Waker, though, so we finally got him.
It took, like, another 4 years, but we did get it.
But we did get Hot Topic Link. And honestly, I just like it when people just delve into the lore of Zelda. I just think that's really neat, and they analyze, like, different design aspects and choices that were made and why and the significance of it. I just think it's neat.
I think it's cool.
Agreed. Well, you know what else is cool? Creature features, Lynels and Wizrobes and Dark Nuts, oh my, with Shona. Our next segment.
Hey folks, Shona Johnson here. I like monsters, and I think that a lot of the enemies in Zelda games are really cool. Last episode, I talked about some of my old mates, the Re-Deads, and I'm back to bring you some more of my favourite enemies. I have a lot of respect for difficult enemies, so today we're talking Lynels, Wizrobes and Darknuts. Lynels and Wizrobes and Darknuts, oh my! Coincidentally, all of these guys have been around since the very first Zelda game, and they were probably some of the most horrible enemies in that game. Lynels haven't actually been a super common enemy across the Zelda franchise, so I wouldn't be surprised if some of you only know them from Breath of the Wild, or maybe even 2019's Cadence of Hyrule. Resembling a cross between a lion and a centaur, they were traditionally the guardians of Death Mountain. You didn't have to face them very often, but when you did, you had to be on your guard to get past or defeat them. I always liked Lynels, even in the first game, but I think that Breath of the Wild has by far the best versions of them. The funny thing is that in Breath of the Wild, you don't actually have to fight any. There's only one part of the game that asks you to get near one, and you can use stealth to avoid it. They are incredibly tough to fight, particularly in the early parts of the game when you're not very well powered or equipped. In fact, they get aggressive as soon as you even approach their territory. They'll stare you down from a distance, and if you don't back off, they'll start shooting at you. I personally found them harder than most of the bosses and mini-bosses in Breath of the Wild. So if you don't actually have to fight these bad boys, then why would you? Because it's a challenge. If you're a player who enjoys combat, like me, it's a lot of fun. It's incredibly satisfying to defeat one for the first time, and there are a lot of different techniques that you can employ to take them down. Farming Lynels ended up being one of my favourite things to do in the game, so I hope that they're back in the sequel, or at least something as equally powerful and intimidating. Now I'm going to be honest with you, when I count Wizrobes among my favourite enemies, I'm talking more about the early incarnations. Early on, they were among the toughest Zelda enemies, but they've undergone a few transformations over the years, and these days I'd say they're more annoying than super difficult to fight. But the idea of enemies who are magicians is always going to be pretty cool, and Wizrobes have a significant creep factor too. They wear robes, and some versions are hooded, while others wear masks, and I used to always wonder what they looked like underneath. Were they people or something else? The ones in Breath of the Wild have their faces peeking out, revealing glowing eyes and large grinning teeth. The Breath of the Wild art book, Creating a Champion, actually has an illustration of what they look like without the robe. It kind of reminds me of a goblin, but I think it's actually creepier when you don't know. Whenever I encounter a Wizrobe for the first time in a new game, I'll always be very wary, even if they turn out to be easy. That's because I've been scarred for life thanks to the blue Wizrobes from the original Legend of Zelda. If I hear the word Wizrobe, a little piece inside me is always going to curl up and be afraid. The original Zelda has two Wizrobe variants, orange and blue, and they're only found in the dungeons. The orange ones appear, shoot a spell at Link, and then disappear. They usually appear in groups, but as long as you move out of the way, it's easy to avoid their attacks, and they take less hits to destroy than the blue ones. The blue ones, however, are always on the screen, constantly moving around, and as soon as Link crosses their path, they fire off a relentless barrage of spells at him. These spells can only be blocked by the magical shield. And whether or not you think it's acceptable to judge a person based on their friends, our dear Zelda 1 Wizrobes truly keep the worst company. They love to hang out with Likelikes, who eat magical shields, and Bubbles, who render your sword powerless for a few seconds, leaving you almost defenseless against them, fumbling for other weapons while trying to avoid their spells. I don't think Wizrobes have ever been quite so horrible since that first appearance. So from wizard enemies, let's move on to knights. Darknuts are heavily armoured enemies who usually wield swords, shields, or maces, so they're certainly no pushover. These enemies are highly skilled in combat, with strong attack and defence, and they sometimes even feature as mini-bosses. It's not uncommon for them to fight in groups, even in 3D titles like Twilight Princess. They're invulnerable to some attacks, so often you need to strip them of their armour or find their weak point. Hint, it's usually the back. My favourite versions are the ones in The Wind Waker and Twilight Princess. They were among one of the tougher enemies in The Wind Waker, although I personally found that game very easy overall, so I'm not sure that says a lot, but they were just plain fun to fight, especially with their variety of combat skills and the way that they adapt to things that happen during the fight. The Darknuts in Twilight Princess are similarly fun to fight, and they also adapt their techniques as the fight progresses. And they come across as a bit more challenging than the ones in The Wind Waker. Now, Darknuts are very similar to another enemy called an Iron Knuckle, which is less common and even tougher. But when I saw Iron Knuckles for the first time in Adventure of Link and later Ocarina of Time, I assumed at first that they were Darknuts. The name Darknut is kind of strange, don't you think? And I always wondered why were they called that? Was it meant to be Dark Knight and it was just a bad translation? Well, they're certainly not Batman, and regardless, the name has just stuck. Like Wizrobes, I used to be really curious about who or what was under the armour. Were Darknuts regular human knights corrupted by Ganon's power, or something else? In The Wind Waker though, you can knock off their helmets to reveal that they have heads that look like a dog, so I think of them more as monsters these days. So there you have a few of my favourite enemies that I love to come up against because they challenge me. Whether it's a bunch of them surrounding me, ready to deal a lot of damage in the old games, or an epic 3D fight that enables me to employ a variety of combat skills, I'll always enjoy facing off against them, even if I don't always come out on top the first time. And if I had to pick a favourite overall, it's definitely the Lynel. I'd love to hear about your favourite enemies. Chat about it in the comments, or tweet at Zelda Universe, and you can even tweet me directly at Shona Adventures. That's S-H-O-N-A Adventures, all as one word. I'm Shona Johnson, and I'll now hand you back to our hosts to continue the episode. Amanda and Alex, I'd love to know what your favourite Zelda enemy is, and why.
All right. So, what are our favorite monsters of Zelda?
Ooh. This is hard. I have a couple answers. Because okay. I really like the Lynels as enemies. They're terrifying to fight against, especially Breath of the Wild. Especially considering the fact that it takes, like, half of your inventory to take down one Lynel in Breath of the Wild. But they're cool looking.
Yeah, they
are. And I like that. I also really like Guardians in Breath of the Wild.
I do like them. I still, anytime I hear that music, I just panic.
I find that music, though, so cool, though. It's like, it is really cool. Music.
They did a wonderful job with it. But that's why I panic.
I just have the visual of Trevino, Alex Trevino, our the guy who does all the dubs for ZU, at PAX East. It was on a slide, and he, like, jumped out of his chair and, like, booked it near an exit for a joke.
Yeah, he did that when we did it at PAX South as well. He went and hid behind the podium.
The level of committing to the bit, I am impressed.
Yeah. Yeah, when we did it at PAX South, we all, like, ducked down and reacted to it. It was great.
See, I like the music. I think it's cool, but I also
it
like,
is great music.
I also really like Guardians in general because I think they're cooler looking and I'd much rather. I'd take them over Skulltulas any day.
Skulltulas, okay. So I'm not a fan of Skulltulas. They're just kind of boring.
Well, here's my issue with it, Arachnophobia. Like, if they're on, if they're going down and up and that's it, I'm fine. I'll take them. That's fine. Once Twilight Princess put them on, like, my plane, no. I'm good. Like, Skyward Sword wasn't as bad to deal with, but Twilight Princess was bad. That was, like, to the point where I had to basically not look at the screen, press A, and just be like, ah!
So, I hate Octorox, just because they keep getting me, and I never see where they're coming from, and then I just get annoyed. I died to more Octorox in Breath of the Wild than anything else. Like, that killed me more than anything. Lizalfos are kind of neat. I'm like you, I really like Lynels. And then I also liked, what was it? Was it called like the Molduga in Breath of the Wild? That giant walrus thing that lived in the sand? Not the...
Oh! I think that is Molduga.
Yeah, I liked him because I liked the music. And then
The music in Breath of the Wild, a lot of it just slaps.
Yeah,
it's
really
pretty
cool.
Good. Because that music is pretty good.
Yep. And then I also like in Skyward Sword, it was Tantalus, the boss battle.
You mean Celia from Monsters, Inc., but Zelda?
Yes, that's what I liked about it. I was like, oh my gosh, it's from Monsters, Inc. This is
you
the greatest monster
freaking
ever.
Would.
That was my favorite. I thought he was so cute, and he looked straight out of Monsters, Inc. So that is why he was my favorite.
That is the most on-brand thing for you, because
I know,
God,
right?
we're such freaking Disney nerds. I can't even, and yet, like, I'm not mad, because that's literally our existence.
Yeah.
Also, honorable mention to Wallmasters.
No, I hate those.
You know why? Only because in Randomizer, they're the easiest way to get out when you need to get out for something.
Oh,
I'll just be
gotcha.
Like, hey, Wallmaster, can you get me out? Tanks.
That's another one that anytime I get hit by a wall or like captured by a wall master, I just start screaming. Like, it doesn't matter where I am or what I'm doing. It just comes down. I'm like, it's getting me. It's getting me.
Let's go into our newest member of the team, Brian Pope, segment all about inventory of cool Zelda merch and all the cool things.
Welcome to Inventory Inquisition, a brand new segment of the ZU Cast, where we cover some sweet Zelda merch released over the years. The aim of the segment is to go over some of the history of the items in question, talk about their significance, and hopefully bring a little insight on some of the weird, wild, and wonderful pieces of the Zelda memorabilia. Hello listeners, Brian Pope here. I'm a writer for the news, columns, and features sections of the website, and it is my distinct privilege to be bringing you the introductory installment of Inventory Inquisition. Since this is the very first Inquisition, I thought I'd cover the very first pieces of my expanded collection of Zelda goodies. Even though the very first game I ever played was A Link to the Past, followed by Link's Awakening, the one release that has had plenty of promotional items, as well as collectible spawn from it, was none other than the Nintendo 64 masterpiece, Ocarina of Time. I can remember Ocarina being one of those games that I played so much that it changed the way my little 8-year-old brain perceived other products. My action figures would have to serve as imaginary placeholders as my hands danced them around, pretending to be Link and Ganondorf battling to the death on the utmost level of the castle. I constantly asked my parents to find me some sort of Zelda action figures to play with, but it was always to no avail. Like my children do now, I'm sure I made up all sorts of toys and spat them out for my parents to go looking for cluelessly as they searched the big department stores in eager measure. But I knew there had to be some sort of Zelda-themed action figure set somewhere, right? At the time, I was also a subscriber to the Nintendo Power magazine, and while visiting my father for the weekend, I was scrolling through the pages and found an insert stashed away towards the back of the publication. My eyes almost bugged out of my head as I read over the insert. It was an order form for Nintendo licensed merchandise, and it included figures of Link, Ganondorf, and even Zelda. I almost died. It didn't help that I had no concept of just how much these figures cost, or the fact that you had to have them shipped to an address and pay for that too, but you get the point. After some eager begging, I managed to snag all the figures they offered and waited what seemed like forever in anticipation, watching the mail, hoping to open the box and find my sought-after treasure. Eventually, the day of destiny came, and my figures found their way to my room and would become the start of my Zelda collection. The packaging for the figures was different, but at the time, it didn't matter, because I practically destroyed the packages anyway. I mean, I was young. What I realize now is that doing some research for this particular Inquisition, that the initial print of the figures featured only Link and Ganondorf in a collectible action figure label produced in normal shelf fashion by a company called Bensusan Deutsch & Associates, often shortened to BDA, with a first run being shipped in January of 1998. My Link figure that came with an adult Link, plastic Master Sword which was rather flimsy, and a Hylian shield was one of these very first run sets. It was part of a Nintendo collectibles brand that featured other Nintendo characters like Mario, Yoshi, and even Rare's Banjo-Kazooie as plushies and plushie keyrings. The actual action figure count was limited, as the company seemed to advertise more of their plush-type products on the back of the cardstock. These figures were produced until 1998, and were even featured in a Target campaign to get customers to pre-order Ocarina of Time by offering Link, Ganon, and Zelda collectible action figures in a set, along with a $10 off coupon towards the game for $10. What wasn't packaged in this deal was sold in a similar fashion to how I found my own Link in a similar brand package. My Ganondorf and Zelda figures were different, though. It turns out that my Ganondorf figure was the one created by Toy Biz in 2000, as Nintendo had halted production of the figures through BDA sometime after their contract was filled in 1998. Toy Biz seemed to pick up the similar designs and add to them, leading to a more fleshed out product. What do I mean exactly? Well, before, the BDA figure of Ganondorf was simply the King of Evil by himself. No accessories or anything like that. The Toy Biz Video Game Superstars versions included Ganondorf with his black and armored stallion, a demonic-looking scepter and spear, I'm not sure which one it is exactly, and even a slip-on mask that resembled Phantom Ganon's skeletal face. Likewise, my Zelda figure was not the adult version of Zelda, but rather Child Zelda with a fully detailed Impa who sported a sword of her own and the horse seen carrying the two away from the kingdom when Ganondorf attempts to take over. The Link version of the Toy Biz print features a different sculpt for the Hero of Time and offers a very bland Master Sword without any blue paint to separate the blade from the hilt. This Link also has an Epona packaged along to match the other horses present in the set, but seems just like an edited base that is a similar sculpt to Impa's horse or vice versa. The collectible figure version features much more vivid but flat colors and better paint choices overall, in my opinion. The Toy Biz Video Game Superstars prints have flavor text that explains the plot of Ocarina of Time, as well as gives some characterization on each character represented in the pack. This is a nice touch and looks better than the bland advertisement found on the 1998 prints. Overall, these figures have withstood the test of time as I played with them hard, and they still retain their paint jobs and articulating points. Sadly, I had stashed the figures away in storage and just recently recovered them some 3 years ago, only to find that I had lost Zelda somewhere along the way, but I had every other accessory. I'm pretty sure if you lose the princess, you lose the game, but that's not important right now, right? Right. Anyway, these figures, like most collectibles, can fetch a high price among collectors who are looking for the set complete in box. The latest prints can be seen to go on as far as 2001 before the company quit printing. Most complete in-box listings go for as little as $100, with Link being particularly harder to find. The Link in this set just looks too doll-like to me, and I'm so very glad that I had the 1998 run of the character without Epona. These figures still hold a special place in my heart because they essentially started what would be an ever-growing collection of Zelda-related merch. These figures spent so much time getting played with, and I was even able to show my own children these toys and see their eyes light up with a similar amazement to how mine did all those years ago. It really is amazing just how much Zelda can stick with you over the years, and these figures will hopefully be around for more years to come, so I can continue to value the memories back then. Did you have these figures growing up? Or if you're a little bit younger or maybe older, obtain these figures for your own collection. Have a piece of merch or series of merch you think we should highlight or cover for next time? Feel free to hit me up at ArcanaFang on the Zelda Universe forums, or if you would like to tweet me, it's at BrianPopeVO. That's BrianPopeVO. Thanks for listening to Inventory Inquisition. I'll see you next time.
Thank you, Brian. Amanda, question.
Yeah. Okay.
What is your favorite Zelda merch that you have?
I got one of the Danielle Nicole purses, and it's really pretty. And what I like about it is that it actually looks girly. It's not just like a forest green with the Triforce just stamped on there. Like, it actually has like a feminine look to it, like it should, because it's a freaking purse for girls. And but it's by Danielle Nicole. It's one of the ones that like GameStop got just like a small handful of them, and then the rest like all got like,
oh, is scalped. It that blue one?
Like, no, the white, it's not the blue one. This one's even better than the blue one. This one is like a white one.
Is it like it a white like, and blue?
I think, yeah, it's white and blue, but it's mostly white. It's super pretty.
I love it. Yes. Fashion. We all about couture.
Yeah, and I also have the matching wallet that goes with it, and it's so pretty.
You see, I don't have anything like that fancy, but I think one of my favorite pieces of Zelda merch, actually I have two. For Valentine's Day last year, my girlfriend bought these canvas wall art of Hyrule as depicted in Breath of the Wild, and it's on my Instagram, but it's like this like 5-piece canvas wall art. That's really cool. And there's also, I think another one is the first four figures Link statue that they sent me to unbox.
Oh, lucky.
That was fun. That was back in college when I got that one. It was like, And that went out like 2 days before Zyuthon 1 happened.
Yeah, I remember when you got it.
Yeah, I think because I got it in like mid-January 2017. And then we filmed it that night. And then it took me 2 months to edit because I am the worst at being consistent in editing. And I also was in school, also working on a film project.
And yet you've managed to pull it off.
Somehow. Entirely know how, but yeah, we are. I think another one of my favorite Zelda things, I really love, there's a great t-shirt that I got from Zelda, from the Nintendo New York store. I don't know if they still sell it, but it's like a long sleeve thing, and it's got like, it looks like it's got like the art from like the Hyrule Historia.
Ooh.
It's like that kind of like design. It's super comfy. I wore it during Zyuthon.
Okay.
If you look at my Zyuthon segment, it's that shirt. And it's really nice and it's super comfy and it feels super great.
I just got a new Zelda shirt, actually. I got it from Box Lunch, and it's Link and Sheik is what it says. And it makes it look like they're a band. And it's really cute.
My girlfriend got me a Lynx with like a Link hat and like a sword in its mouth that I loved it. I love it
so
much.
Oh, I have a shirt that has a Lynx on it and it says a Lynx to the past, and it's so cute.
Now let's do a bit of a pivot.
So now we're going to the final installment of Randy's series, Hyrule, Away from Hyrule, Back to Hyrule.
Friends, I've been talking a lot over the past several months about how The Legend of Zelda looks from outside of the games themselves. Whether it was our references in World of Warcraft, appearances in Soul Calibur games, or licensed board games and serials, The Legend of Zelda has proven to be quite versatile in its presentation. Hello, I'm Randy Marr, and welcome back to Hyrule Away from Hyrule. I set out to create this series so we could look at the Zelda franchise from outside the context of the video games we all know and love and have built a site around. I wanted to look at Zelda on the outside, from within, and take that knowledge and come back to examine the franchise itself. I can't begin to tell you how fun this has been. I learned a lot of new and interesting things about what people get out of Zelda games. And with all this research, the presentations, and talking to a lot of fans about why they love the franchise, I think I've come to some interesting conclusions. I'd like to present those all to you here, and I hope you'll keep an inquisitive mind. If I have learned one key thing from all this, it's that Link, Zelda, Ganon, and everyone else involved each represent different things to different people. More than most games and franchises and series, I think The Legend of Zelda has a flexibility and a versatility to it that few, if any, can match up with. For starters, I believe that the single most important aspect of any Zelda game is the characters. Controversial opinion, I know, but from the beginning, it's something we all remember. Finding new characters drive us to explore, be it to new parts of Hyrule, or different relationships, or new parts of the story. It makes sense, after all. If you're gonna save the world, you might as well know who you're saving. Each game has a vastly different array of characters. While many will share similarities in races or roles, they're usually all ultimately unique. In the original Legend of Zelda, the few and far between characters were cryptic and ominous. The whole land had a sense of dread to it, with monsters crawling in every corner, and the people were all driven into dark caves to survive. But what was that one elder doing in the middle of a dungeon? And why do they always speak in riddles? It's a very David Lynch quality to it, I think, and in fact, I believe that Lynch has inspired most of the developers at some point or another when it comes to focusing on the concept of memorable characters. Ganondorf might actually be the only true reoccurring character on the grand scheme of things. He's trapped in this cycle of destruction and resurrection, not too dissimilar to Dracula in Castlevania's. While our Link and Zelda in any given game may look similar, they are almost always unique characters. And each time you visit a new revision of Hyrule, you're treated to an almost entirely new cast of memorable folks. It's interesting to me that this doesn't seem to be an issue for the series, which does have a tendency to just rewrite itself as it sees fit. Discovering strange new characters is just as important to a lot of people as finding new sub-items or heart pieces. And if you don't believe me, let me ask you to remember the minigames in Wind Waker. Okay, when I ask you to remember the minigames in Wind Waker, what word immediately pops into your head? Just one word, maybe an image. You got it yet? I'm willing to bet the first thing you thought of was either Sploosh or Kablooey. Salvatore is not a major character in any capacity. His minigames aren't required to progress, he has no role outside of minigame hosting, and yet he remains one of the many standout characters in The Wind Waker. Somebody sat down and gave him all the attention needed to make him stand out in a cast of outstanding characters. Why does he hold up the portraits to act as different people? That took a lot of animations and additional assets that really didn't need to be there for any reason, but it was absolutely worth every ounce of effort in the end. The characters make Hyrule feel like a real, lived-in place, over and over again. Whether you remember helping Cafe and Anju have their perfect wedding, or remember the first time you heard Cass's song and discovered a giant birdman, each one manages to leave at least some little bit of an impression on you. It's our attachment to these characters that helps anchor us to the series. We all have our favorites and continue to find new ones with each game. Whether you're a lore hunter, an explorer, or even combat-oriented Zelda player, it's the people that give you everything you need to continue moving forward. I'd like to thank you again for listening. Always appreciate your time. My name again was Randy. You can find me on Twitter at RandyMarGames or writing various things on ZeldaUniverse.net. And now for the rest of the podcast.
Woo! Randy, you did it. You finished the series. I actually really liked Hyrule Away from Hyrule. It's a really great retrospective of all the stuff that Zelda has touched. And it's kind of cool to see like how important the Zelda franchise has been in a lot of other things.
I really like just seeing how much Zelda has influenced different forms of entertainment over the years, whether it be gaming or made references into music or TV shows or movies. Just the fact that it has made such an impact is just so cool to me.
Yeah, especially in like the entertainment side. Like I interviewed a guy named Dave Malloy who wrote Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812, who actually was inspired a lot by the music in Zelda to put that through in his work. And I got to interview him, and I was one of his favorite interviews during the whole process, which was so cool. Big fan of Ocarina of Time and wants to write a Metroid musical. So Nintendo, hit him up. He's making a Moby Dick musical right now, but after that, Metroid? Just saying.
Well, everybody, thank you for joining us for another ZU cast. Alex, thank you for hosting with me.
Thank you for coming with the host. Remember, you can send us feedback.
Because we have not received any feedback for this one, and I would love to get some as long as it's nice feedback. Because if it's bad feedback, I'm going to like say you're wrong. So, Alex, where can people find you if they want to see more of your work or just want to tweet at you or Insta you? Where can they find you?
Please tweet and Instagram me at Luca_Starks on the Twitter, on the Instagram, on the Twitch. If you want to find my YouTube stuff, take out the underscore. It's there. And then alexrosenberg.net and other places. And then I'm on Realms of the Wild occasionally?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Amanda Van Hiel. Van Hiel is spelled V-A-N-H-I-E-L. I always have to spell it because nobody ever knows how to spell it correctly. You can also find me on Instagram because I post some Zelda things on there on occasion and cosplay and gaming cool stuff there. It is Slytherin's Queen. Go ahead and laugh at me. I don't care. I came up with it as a joke and then it just stuck. And you can also follow me on Twitch at Panda Princessa. And then I also stream on the Zelda Universe TV channel. I do Running Blind, where I play games I haven't played before.
Woo! Thank you for listening, and we will see you at some point later in the ZUcast land thing. Yup, that's it. That's the outro.
Bye, guys.
Good night, everybody. Thanks for listening.
You've reached the end of another exciting episode of the ZU Cast. Let's take a few to acknowledge all of the nerds who made this episode possible. Your hosts were Amanda Van Hiel and Alex Rosenberg. Brian Thomas was back for another edition of
Hey, Listen!
To take a look at how the Master Sword has evolved over the years, like some sort of pocket monster. Shona Johnson presented the second part of her monster-focused series, Creature Features, to discuss Lionel's Wizrobes and Darknuts. Oh my! Our newest team member, Brian Pope, the second in our growing collection of Brians, kicked off his dissection of Link's inventory in Inventory Inquisition. Welcome to the ZUBC, Brian! Randy Marr wrapped up his Hyrule Away from Hyrule series, which, if you can believe it, debuted on the first episode of the reboot back in October 2018. Thanks for such a cool series of segments, Randy. Can't wait for the next one. Eden Biskin presented the staff credits this episode. Is presenting. Will have presented? This is getting timey-wimey. Anyway, I'm the executive producer. Cody Davies is our consulting producer, and insert clip here of Cody saying,
"Yee howdy."
Kelly Timmerman is our head editor, which is French or something for editor. Probably. Pietro Bucci and Mary Stowe relate with our public with PR magic. Joshua Lindquist is technically our technical advisor, officially. Joshua Realmwings and Peyton Garrett do all of the graphics for our audio podcast. The ZUcast is a production of the ZUBC, a division of Zelda Universe. Give us feedback via email at podcast@zeldauniverse.net, via the ZU forums and the ZUcast Hub 2020 thread in Community Central, and or via ZU's social media. Our social media is as follows. At Zelda Universe on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and Zelda Universe TV on YouTube and Twitch. The hosts may read it and respond to it on air, so if you want 5 minutes of fame, you know what to do. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time. Until then, stay healthy.
I'm Shona Johnson, and I'll now Sorry, I'll just do that last little bit again.
I mean, actually, that's a kind of a quick turnaround for a Zelda game, because what was it, 2002 and then 2005?
Twilight Princess came out in 2006, 2007, because I was really? In college at the time. Yeah, because that was a Wii GameCube title.
Wait, but wasn't the Wii 05?
Wii was 06, I think.
Are my timelines in... Oh, it was 2006. What the f***?
Shona Johnson presented the second part of her monster...
We could talk about the monsters.
The monsters of Zelda. The monsters of Zelda. Ba-ba-ba-da-ba-bats.
Someone make that a series. Someone call HBO. We got a Zelda series. I know you're working on Last of Us, but shelve it.
Shelve it for the monsters of Zelda. Yep. All right. Let's get back on track so we don't get murdered by Kelly.
Yes. Okay. Perfect.
Sorry. Sorry, Eslo. Sorry, whoever's editing this.
Kelly. Probably.
Oh, sorry, Kelly. I hope you'll forgive me.
Come see the cats, and then go see Cats, the movie.
No, God.
Everyone needs to see that hellhole of a trip.
Oh my gosh, that movie was terrifying.
I went day one.
I know. I went with Elias and Jake, and
you were with them.
We were supposed to drink beforehand, and we didn't have time.
So you were in that thread.
Yes.
My God.
Yeah, I was with him that whole time.
Now, which version did you see? Was it the one that they fixed?
No, it was not, because I saw the wedding ring on Judi Dench, and I saw all the cats wearing like tennis shoes.
Oh, I can't wait for the DVD to come out so I can rip it onto my computer and then make a video about me tearing it to shreds.
Oh, gosh. It was... And, you know, just the whole, like, old Deuteronomy just looking at the camera at the very end.
I was so uncomfortable with that. I was just like, too. Why? I get that you're addressing the audience, but holy shit. Why... Judi Dench is
like,
staring
this whole time,
into my soul.
Nobody addressed the audience, and so why are you going to all of a sudden address the audience?
You know, Tom Hooper. I don't understand him as a director. I
don't understand that why that movie was what it was.
I mean, the movie did not need to exist. It might have worked better as an animated movie, but even then, I don't even know how you would even be able to pull that one off.
I think if it were animated, it would have been okay, honestly.
Well, yeah, but I still don't... They would still have to motion cap the crap out of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, but they could do it like as they're all like a bunch of Khajiits as opposed to like humanoids.
I would have been totally game with that, to be honest. But...
Right, like, that was the first thing I thought. I was like, why aren't they just
doing Khajiits? I feel like Disney could have done a better job at this than Universal could have. But Universal paid for the rights. And they let Tom Hooper have a lot of problems. Granted, apparently they used the same company that did the Sonic revisions.
Hmm.
But like,
which was a good movie.
But how did Sonic end up so good and Cats became a hot mess?
Because Cats is just a hot mess in general.
I mean, the musical is flawed, and that's putting it mildly, but like,
yeah.
At the same time, it's unprecedented.
The biggest problem is they changed too much of it. They added dialogue into what is a rock opera, which should not have any dialogue, and they tried to put a plot there that doesn't exist.
Well, okay, I'll say this. The plot was there. They're better at streamlining it to make sure people are remembering that plot exists, because they only explain the plot in the musical once. It's at the very beginning.
The plot is it's a kitty cat death cult.
Yes. This is probably blooper, so I don't care if you add it. But please feel free to add this, Kelly. You can do whatever you want. But this rant's going to stay, at least in my cut. And you can do whatever you want. Cats is basically the Jellicle Cats meet once a year at the Jellicle Ball, where they all rejoice and they decide to make the Jellicle choice that one cat goes up and gets reborn. Death cult.
That means
yes.
They pick one cat to kill. It's a kitty cat death cult.
Yes, but in the musical, they say it once. And then the rest of the show is introducing all these cats. That is literally the all plot. The movie is better at making that clear, but it's still a shoestring plot to tie together poems that don't really connect.
I want a big budget Starlight Express. That's what I want.
Oh my God. I
want like CGI Thomas the Tank Engine trains looking realistic.
Kelly, if you put this in, please find photos of Starlight Express so people can understand. Oh God. I would see that, but I have no idea how the hell they would. Do you think they've sold film rights to that?